UCB Theater podcast for the week of October 17th, 2010.
Yep.
We did it.
That's right.
Sitting across from me is the ever-stoic Will Hines.
And across from me is the Epicurean John Frusciante.
And with us today is Dinah Moe.
Hello, Dinah.
Hello, how are you doing today?
We're doing, you know, the same.
Yeah, you know, it's the same old thing.
Yeah, thanks so much for being on the show. Dinah, so what, John, what are we doing? What's the plan?
Dinah is going to talk about her new book, Mad Men, The Illustrated World,
yes.
Which she illustrated and wrote. She's also going to talk to us about the movie, the fact that she's directing the movie right now.
The improv movie.
Yeah, yes. not the concept of a movie in general. And also the history of the movie, going back to feature, things like that.
Uh-huh.
And all of the various wonderful things she's been involved in at the UCB Theater.
Yeah, so, Dinah, you're how do you say someone who's been around forever?
Veteran.
UCB.
You're a UCB veteran.
Old, yeah, right.
Or you're an old person.
I'm very old.
You've been involved in the theater in all of its incarnations, currently, and then 22nd Street, and even back in solo arts, you were involved.
Yes.
So we got a lot to cover.
Yeah. Let's start with a book, though. So Mad Men, The Illustrated World, it's The Illustrated World, right? Yeah. Just came out. You're a huge, you've done a lot of illustrations for Mad Men and the world of Mad Men.
Yes.
Right.
Well, it's a UCB-centered project, oddly enough, making it relevant for this podcast. But as Mad Men watchers may know, the character of Harry Crane is played by UCB alum Rich Sommer, who was on a Herald team here, and it's through him that I ended up becoming the official Mad Men illustrator, if a position like that could exist. That's what I am.
Mm-hmm. And what's that story?
I was working, appropriately enough, at an ad agency where most of what I did was wait. I spent at least 90% of my day waiting for someone to come tell me to do something. There was no allowed internet chat or anything, but I had emails, so I started emailing Rich Sommer, who I had known very casually. I had, like, coached his group once. I, like, passed him in a hallway. I would see him drunk at parties. But once I was in the ad agency, I said, oh, I've seen your show. This is when it first premiered. And said I, you know, asked him a lot of backstage trivia, which he very magnanimously answered. And then after about 2 months of this, he said, hey, I'd like to do a Christmas card. Would you help me illustrate it? And I was like, well, I'm already being paid to sit in this ad agency, do nothing. I might as well spend about 8 hours a day working on your Christmas card for the next 2 months. So I ended up drawing it in the style of sort of late 50s, early 60s Christmas ads, which were sort of cartoon affairs of happy families eating turkeys and putting up Christmas trees, and sort of did it for free because I didn't think that, oh, he has money because he's on a TV show. And he sent that Christmas card to his fellow cast members and crew members and production staff of the show. And from that, I was embraced backstage and I started doing little projects for behind the scenes on the show. And I've talked about this on, like, the DVD extra of Mad Men Season 3, if you want to see me say this with my face instead of my voice.
We'll make sure it syncs up.
But, wait, that doesn't make any sense.
We'll make sure. We'll go back and I will retro-edit all your audio so that it is the exact same order of words.
So you can watch it and listen to it at the same time.
Yeah. Except I'm saying completely different things.
I'll make it work.
Okay. Thanks, Tim Gunn.
Yep.
Well, the short answer is that they liked the Christmas card. From there, I ended up officially doing projects for AMC, which is based in New York. The show's filmed in L.A. So I did the Mad Men Yourself avatar-making toy and a couple other things that were given just to advertisers. And then from there became the official drawing face of a very serious TV drama, cute little cartoon version. I mean, it makes so little sense that I can't even justify it, but that's how things happened. And so an editor at Penguin wanted a Mad Men book, contacted me. I was agreed to do it for whatever reason. But they needed it done in 90 days so that it would be in stores by Christmas. So I turned to the UCB community to handle most of the writing so I could spend more time on the art.
Mm-hmm.
So there's about 12 people who worked on it. All but two are UCB Herald team members or Mod team members or mm-hmm. former team members.
Yeah.
Will, you were one of the
Yeah, I think I did two of the pages, I think.
Yes, you did two pages, each of which have about 10 words on them.
Not more than 10 words, but I'll accept your slam.
You're a great artist, both in the book, the Madman stuff, and all the stuff that you have done for the UCB shows and flyers and posters throughout
Thank
the
you.
Years. You're welcome. How much of the style that you drew in were you familiar with going into it? Did you have to do research on it, or was it something that you were you knew of?
I vaguely knew it, but thanks to, you know, you could go onto the internet and there's some crazy person who collects magazines for the last 40 years who scans everything. But yeah, I would constantly be looking up new vintage ads to make sure that they looked appropriately period. I mean, other than the fact that I'm clearly doing it with a computer and make no bones about making it look aged, it's I tried to be as true to the source material as possible, but then you get to a point where there really isn't a photo reference of a vintage ad of someone who's been clubbed on the floor of a dirty motel by two Vietnam fleeing hippies, and you kind of have to use your imagination.
You were also doing, that reminds me that you did a lot of, every week you would draw one scene that you liked or one image that you liked from the show and put it online, and there was a big response to that too, right?
Yeah, that's the step I skipped in my narrative, where I did the Christmas card. I was supposed to do a different project for the show, which fell through because of miscommunication and money. So I had all this Mad Men art I had already done for a project that no longer existed. So I just put it on the internet, and then that sort of got blogged and blogged and blogged and blogged. And then near the end, I was getting, you know, on some days 80,000 hits for a weekly update. But yeah, for two seasons, I drew an episode every week of the show, a memorable scene from it in the style of 60s ad art.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say it makes no sense that your simple cartoony versions took off, but it does make sense because the show itself is so art-directed. I mean, a lot of the appeal of the show is how carefully the look is orchestrated, you know, accurately a lot of times, then sort of selectively exaggerated at times. And then your drawings are so carefully stylized that makes sense. And then also a lot, not all of them, but a lot of those weekly drawings you put up had sort of a weird like a funny sort of twist to it or focus. Even something like Joan and the Copy Machine, which is, I think, was that's one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the more popular ones, right?
Yeah, it was the first one I did.
Something about just choosing that image and realizing that the show was sort of not fetishizing the copy machine, but that it was like this huge, beautiful novelty and that she was such sort of this beautiful novelty. Like, it added a lot. Mm-hmm. Your sense of humor and what to focus on brought a lot out. So yeah, I think it made perfect sense.
Well, the heightening of this is the fact that once you're doing cartoons of a very dramatic show and they ask you to write a book on it and they want it done very quickly and they ask a humor writer to write it, is basically I've written 100 pages of jokes about Mad Men and had it published as the first official Mad Men publication,
yeah,
which is equally strange.
Pretty amazing too.
Yeah, that at no point anyone said this is a terrible idea. But the fact is that it's actually selling very well, and it actually oddly what they wanted was a book that people would buy for friends who they knew nothing about other than the fact that they knew Mad Men.
Yeah.
So basically, it's designed as a Christmas gift for bad friends.
Yeah.
And it fulfills it very well. I'm sure your friend or Secret Santa who received this book will be very happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's not, you know, leaves of grass. It's a picture
book. It's not a compendium of Mad Men info, per se.
No. I mean, there's been other unofficial books that do it very well that are very researched and had experts come in. this was a book written by a cartoonist slash comedian, and you will enjoy it. I'll put it that way. You probably won't be very enlightened by anything in it, but it will be an enjoyable experience for you.
And there are dessert recipes in there and things like that.
Yeah, there's a board game.
Yeah, let's see. What do we have in here? We have
Anyway, you should buy it, I guess.
Yeah, everybody should pick it up. People who like Mad Men should definitely get it. I know there's a lot of people in the UCB community who love the show.
It's as Dinah is implying, the content is sort of insane in that it's like very funny and a lot of funny points of view and takes on the show. Yeah, I think like you can imagine that the original idea was, let's get a gift book out of Mad Men. Mm-hmm. These illustrations are great and there's a following. If we have that, we like it. But then on top of it, there's this sense of humor. And like you say, you farmed it out to several people, even though most of the ideas were yours.
Yeah, I wrote sort of an outline of what I wanted, and in some cases would write sort of the first beat of the joke or the first paragraph of the whatever the bit was. But just sort of, I went to first people who were in my movie class who I knew needed money and didn't have day jobs and were very funny, and asked them, and then sort of as it went on, asked reliable friends who I knew were very funny, like Sylvia and Will Hines. And I sort of, the non-UCB people I asked, one was a stand-up in Chicago who I met through the Improv Resource Center board like 10 years ago and have met in person once. But I knew that he needed money and was a funny writer and had a kid and needed to feed them so and liked Mad Men. So I said, hey, can you, here are some topics. Can you give me some stuff on it? And then the other person I asked who ended up writing probably the most of it was a college friend who used to be a professional researcher for the Eleanor Roosevelt Society. So she knew a lot about post-World War II and Cold War culture. So I said, hey, and would actually research the stuff, which I certainly wouldn't do. And she ended up writing really funny material, even though she's a complete non-comedian. So the recipe stuff is all hers, and she actually wrote the Cuban Missile Crisis board game, which is nothing but jokes. So some of the funniest bit in this was written by just a comedy fan who has no comedy experience.
Well, in your original, the things you were putting up every week, the two most overtly, like, sort of funny things were Sally Draper makes your drinks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a great
one. Based
on
this one shot of when you see Sally pouring a drink for her dad in the first season, I think.
And it's like five-part vodka to one-part tomato juice.
Yeah, she's learned how to make it for her alcoholic father.
Yeah.
So that, your original sort of like placemat designed how to mix drinks the way you might see like at a diner.
Both of those are in the book, only they've now been spell-checked.
And the other one is the paper doll. That's the other one you're talking about, right? The paper doll outfits for Joan.
Oh, yeah. Another great one, yeah.
So those, you know, even in the original sort of incarnation were sort of like funny frameworks for this illustration. The book is just more of that, I think.
Right.
Rather than just like a scene from the show drawn.
Yeah, there's actually nothing in world having to do with the show. There's no, at no point in the book do I pretend that Don Draper is a real person.
Yeah.
It's just about things that happen in the early 60s.
I think it's super cool. Obviously, I'm biased because I'm part of it. But unlike some sort of cookie cutter, here's just a checklist of things that were mentioned in Mad Men. There's a blood and humor in this book in a way that I think makes it fun. And randomness. I think the 90-day deadline that you were unfairly saddled with, that made you kind of farm out to a lot of people and sort of have to throw it together to some degree,
right,
makes it sort of a slapdash in a fun way.
Yeah.
In a way that, like, if you had another year, you might, you know, bring all of the different voices closer together to some similar voice.
There'd probably be more input from the various legal departments that had to approve this, but we were basically largely unsupervised.
But that's a lot of great things, like Yellow Submarine and the Beatles was sort of like not done with the Beatles really having any idea what was going on. It was like just farmed out to people they thought were cool.
You know, the animator who designed Yellow Submarine, he actually was an avant-garde animator before that, and his pure movies that he did by himself are crazy.
Yeah,
but they look like Yellow Submarine. It's like stuff where people's faces melt off and become, I mean, they're super psychedelic, but it's still figures that look like Yellow Submarine people, kind of big feet and like little weird pinched faces.
Yeah.
Only like with the most acid trippy visuals. It's like if Yellow Submarine was made for nobody.
Yeah.
An audience of zero.
So I think, like, you know, there's a tradition of sort of just being like, we like what you do, do what you want. You know, inspired by our property.
Right.
Or whatever.
So, take your sensibility and your point of view.
Yeah.
And apply it to this thing.
I think it's funny you guys are trying to cheer me up about this book or just justify it in some way.
Well, I think it's interesting for this reason. I know you well enough to not bother trying to cheer you up. What's some...
And this is the second conversation I've ever had with you, so...
Yeah, you should have conversations about me. They get back to me.
So we were talking, we touched briefly about how you've been involved at the UCB Theater since...
1998.
So how did you come upon the UCB and the UCB Theater?
This is the part where I said I need to prepare the notes so I can remember this.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so I'll try and make this brief and hopefully interesting. I went to Wesleyan University for 3 semesters, which is a college in Connecticut. In a town that you used to live in, Will Hines.
That's right.
In No, wait, you never lived in Middleton.
My youngest brother lives there, is okay. what you're thinking. Yeah.
You lived in Ridgefield, but that's right. where my parents lived. Okay, rewind. So I went to Wesleyan University with Ari Vakitis, who's currently on a Herald team, DeCoster, and Chard Carter, who is at UCB LA now, but he used to be UCB New York guy. He also works for Funny or Die. We were on a college improv team, along with Eli Newell, and I don't know what Eli does now, but he used to be around.
He's on Delocated.
Oh, he's on Delocated.
Yeah.
And he has awesome pictures on his Tumblr of him and, like, wildlife and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So
he's
doing cool
adventures. He and Chad Carter go shark hunting or swordfish.
Right. Some big manly thing that I can't connect to.
Right.
So anyway, Ari and Chad particularly, and Eli to a secondary degree, were all in this college improv group at Wesleyan University. They're 4 years older than me, so they graduated. And I said, enough of this, and basically dropped out of college after three semesters and moved to New York in 1998. And once here, I spent a summer in L.A. at that year, but basically moved here knowing absolutely no one, enrolled in NYU Film, but didn't know anyone there either. So Ari invited me to come see him do improv in this show called Immortal Kombat, which was at Solo Arts, which was like the second or third non-ASCAT UCB show. They rented the space Solo Arts, which was very strange. You had to go up this long. Will Hines has been there. You might have been there, too.
No, I actually was never there.
You have to go up this like weird fire escapey stairs. There was like a doctor's office also in the lobby, which I mainly know because Walsh got in a fight with that doctor about something, claiming he was a doctor, too. And that somehow explained why he was able to have a fight. I don't know. So anyway, they did this show, Mortal Kombat, which most people know is a warm-up or an exercise. Where basically people have improv superpowers and they kind of, you do a scene but you fuck with it. I could never, and then before that was Herald Night, the very crude early version of Herald Night, but I had a class that night, so I never saw Herald Night, but I always saw Mortal Kombat for like 3 months. And, you know, from the hindsight of actually doing improv, it was not a good show. It was a kind of patently awful show. But I went every week and got to know everyone at UCB, so the next time they had registration for classes, that didn't interfere with my college courses, I registered. And in my level one was James Eason, Doug Moe, Jackie Clark, Mark Sarian, Bob Wiltfong, all prominent names to some of your listeners, and a handful of whom are still in New York and still around. And I think Jess Chaffin, but she didn't join us until level two. I mean, like, this is... It's 12 years ago, so bear with me.
Sure.
But yeah, we took level 1, 2, 3, and 4 with the UCB 4. And oddly enough, Armando Diaz's first class teaching level 1 was our level 1. And then I had Ali Farinakian for level, I guess it would be 5. So I've hit all the major theaters in my first year at UCB.
Yeah.
And I was put on a Herald team after my level 2. Sorry, folks. with Owen Burke and Rob Hubel and a bunch of other people. And then from there was on the most thing I'm most associated with or best known or most, you know, enjoyed. I was in the first movie group at UCB called Feature Feature with the Naked Babies and various other folks, Scott Armstrong of Old School and whatever the fuck movie he made after that. So I did the movie for 3 years and then started teaching the movie and... you know, did a bunch of different weird... I mean, the theater was a much odder place 10 years ago. So
sure.
I was in all kinds of really strange shows that nobody remembers.
Yeah, the community was smaller. There was a lot, like you said, a lot more weirder,
there were
random stuff happening.
I've told Will this before, and he might recall this as well. In the beginning, the people who took UCB classes because they were basically unadvertised was super hardcore comedy nerds and mentally unstable people. And I'm not using that euphemistically. I mean, like, people who were functionally autistic, low-level retarded. Like, those were the people who took UCB classes and were on UCB teams. And it was a much more interesting place. And the comedy definitely was pulling from a wider well than we are now, but, you know, whether that's worse or better.
In what way do you mean pulling from a wider well?
You got a special skill being on a team with a functionally retarded person in terms of how you played games with them. I don't think the comedy was better, but it definitely, it was sort of the improv equivalent of that thing where you run through a bunch of tires in basic training.
Because there's more of a challenge improvising with
those kinds of people. Yeah, there's less coherency in your scenes when someone jumps up from behind a chair and says, "I'm a bear," in every scene you're in, no matter what has been established up to that point. But, you know, interesting people. And New York is full of, I mean, the downtown theater scene's full of, quote, interesting people, both who are very enjoyable at times and then very trying at times. But you can say that for anyone. It just was on this very huge macro level.
Certainly.
Let's talk about a feature. That show was one of my favorite shows, and it was up. I watched it a bunch of times.
Great show.
Feature and The Swarm were the two shows I was willing to bring my non-comedy, non-New York friends to see and know that they would like it.
And they were also two of the shows that, as you know, you were studying coming up, you would go and watch to learn how to do it correctly.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So, like you said, feature was Cordry and Bowie and Seth and
Husky. Secunda,
Scott Armstrong,
Jamie,
Wilburson, and me, Don.
Just the powerhouses of the theater back then.
How old were you then, Don? Are you like 21 or something?
I think it was 20 when it started, but 21 for most of it. I graduated college in the middle of our run, and so that was interesting.
I've heard actually. Bowie used to talk about it and how the cast of the movie would be able to tell you exactly what the last movie in a particular genre or a particular era was and when, like, a new genre, a new era of that genre started. Like, you were all basically super film nerds
in
that cast.
We were 50-50. We were super hardcore film nerds like Secunda and Bowie and me to a degree. But then we had sort of super weird character people, like Husky. This is not to say they didn't know a lot about movies, but like people who were totally committed to extremely bizarre characters, which is the balance in doing the movie is you have to be both very academic about the form and the genre stuff, but you also have to be able to commit to the most extreme. You know, in Harold's, particularly lately, they really emphasize keeping it grounded and realistic. But if you're doing a movie where someone's like a 9-foot-tall robotic owl shooting lasers out of their face, but you also have to play a game about losing your car key, you have to make both aspects completely believable, which is like a Seth or a Husky can like totally play ridiculous character.
I remember some Barbarella parody where Husky was the Barbarella character. He's Jane Fonda.
It was Genitella.
That's right. But Seth was a kid bot. He was like this robot sidekick of Will Burson. They drove around in a dune buggy for the entire movie. Burson's sort of like furrowed brow trying to figure out his life, and kid bot Seth perched up with his arms forward like little Tyrannosaurus Rex arms, teeth planted over his lower lip for the entire show.
There was also a masturbating computer in that played by Bowie, I think.
That's right.
Because basically Husky took off his clothes and it's Husky, sort of, you know, alley catted around, and then a computer masturbated until it exploded. I don't actually remember what I was in that movie, but I do remember Genitella pretty well. But yeah, we did it for 3 years, and it was this, you know, weird combination of super bizarre characters that had to be tied to a plot that was a specific genre and made sense and was 25 minutes.
How did the suits happen?
The suits happened, well, we sort of took over our own show. Like, we didn't have a director. Besser taught the class. Should I just talk about the movie back up a little bit?
Sure, okay. It was, go
so,
ahead.
So the movie, also called Movie Form, was a form created by Del Close with the family as a part of a 1988 show called Three Mad Rituals, where they did the Herald, they did like a montage,
Deconstruction.
Deconstruction, and then they did the movie, and the movie was new for this form. And then at, the, I think, the first marathon they had, the first Del Close marathon, they had the family, or most of the family, get back together, and they did the Three Mad Rituals as a part of their marathon slot. And it was really super duper sloppy because they hadn't seen each other in like, you know, whatever it was, 6 years and hadn't performed together. But this was the first time anyone had seen the movie, and it was sort of such a, it was like a science fiction movie about these people in glass pods, but also they were like warriors who rode ostriches, and there was a big battle at the end. I mean, it was like a really convoluted plot, but they were doing the cutaways and the camera angles and stuff, which no one had ever seen before at UCB. So from that, Besser decided he wanted to have a group that would just do the movie, and he put together a class, and I had just sort of progressed into it with my same group that I mentioned, and it was definitely sort of Besser's classes were basic training as well. They were very intense. There was sort of no mercy and, you know, could you endure it kind of things. Which I didn't have a problem with. I mean, I was scared of him. I probably still am scared of him. But like,
yeah, that's the legend of him. I never had a chance to study with him, but the legend.
And
he's
nice.
Terrifying.
Apparently, he's nice now. Which I don't know. But you know, there were all these rumors that Besser made someone cry on their birthday on stage, and you know, Besser did this. It was as if I never saw him being outrageously cruel. I saw him being tactless. But he was very serious. He wanted people to actually know what they were doing and demanded that they explain themselves immediately.
Well, this is at a time when the theater's fighting to establish itself in the city. Like, now it's, you know, a thing that's going to be around. But at that time, when you were doing this show, they're fighting for credibility.
Sure. And I mean, there was also sort of a studio system in place where, you know, getting on Besser's good graces meant that you'd be cast in the next show or you'd be put on a Terrell team. It really was like, you have to get through this so that in win his favor, and then once you do that, the world's your oyster. So he did this class and basically decided half the people in the class did not know how to do a Herald at all. But like his handpicked, you know, 10 of us, we were okay, and we could learn the movie. So we would learn the movie, and then he would send us out to the parking lot to practice. But there's now a building there. This is at 22nd Street.
Oh yeah, across the street, it used to be a parking lot. Yeah, I remember that.
And then he would drill the other people in how to do a Herald, and then we would have to come back and do a movie, and then he would grill us on the movie, and then the other group would get up and they would do a movie, and then he would grill them. So we started teaching two classes once, and then those of us he liked in the class, or maybe I'm getting this backwards. I know that he made the people he liked take the class again with a new group, and the people he didn't like, he just sort of passed on to the next class. But he thought they were good enough at doing the movie, they had to take the class again with him, and then from those two classes, he made the group that became Feature. And then after that, he said, our show is called 3D Movie Live. He introduced it. It was sort of done as like a kind of crazy stoner like party thing. And then after like one or two shows like that, Secunda asked to join the cast. So Secunda kind of bullied his way into the class. He wasn't, or bullied his way into the cast. He never took the class, but he was a great addition. And then we decided, you know, let's raise the tenor of this. Let's not be like the weird stoner show. So they all decided we were going to wear suits and formal wear and dresses to legitimize this kind of crazy form. We changed the name to Feature, which I think Scott Armstrong came up with, Hollywood screenwriter. Scott Armstrong named her group. And then we did it for 3 years. In our first anniversary, we did a black tie and red carpet wear. And my parents came to that, and they thought it was okay. It was really, really fun form. I wish it could have happened forever, but eventually, you know, people become famous and have to move to L.A. And I think we were the first show that suffered greatly from the L.A. Exodus, the very first one. Is like we started losing people a year into our show. Will Burson left to go work for Scrubs, I think. And then, like, Jamie was not there a lot of time anyway because she always went to pilot season. And then, you know, Cordray got Daily Show. So basically people started bleeding out, like, pretty quickly into our run. So we picked up Jason Mantzoukas. And then in the second theater, Owen Burke was a big fan. He wanted the show to come back, so it came back with Owen Burke. And then sort of just became sort of people had too much other stuff going on, so people took off. And for a while, I was the only member of Feature who still lived in New York, but Secunda came back. So there are two of us who live here out of the original nine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you think the popularity of the movie is? Because I think students, you know, we teach it at least once a year. Probably once a year it's settled into now. And it's always really popular. I think there's I guess not always, but almost always a pretty strong demand for it. And certainly it grows back much more quickly than for other forms.
I think people like movies. And I think a lot of people in the ECB community are frustrated screenwriters or frustrated filmmakers. So the movie kind of scratches that itch. But also it's a really visual form. If you've never seen the movie, come to the ECB Theater this Tuesday and next Tuesday to see the student group that I most currently taught doing it, but you'll see what I mean about we simulate camera angles on stage. It also has really big characters and sort of doing mundane things. I think that's the sort of base alpha game structure of all movies is extremely huge characters doing really mundane things, which you know is appealing to watch. Like I said, if you want to see a three-headed space general get hungover, you're going to see it in the movie. if things line up and go correctly. I also think it's very there's kind of some safeguards in that, so that it's very easy to do an okay movie, but it's also very hard to do a fantastic movie because you have to overcome kind of the initial silliness and make it convincing. And you also have to juggle the plot, the game, the time, the angles, the visuals, all at the same time. So when it comes together, it's like nothing else.
And as somebody who was a veteran of doing it and of teaching it, how do you do all those things that you were talking about well? Like, how does somebody who, when you're teaching the movie, what do you encourage them to do in order to get that balance in order?
Well, the difficulty is, so the way I teach the movie, and I've taught it now for 5.5 years or 6 years, sometimes with other people, sometimes alone, the thing that it's very hard to teach, because the person performing the movie has to have a vast reserve of movie knowledge, which isn't a given. I've definitely had students who the only movie they'd ever seen was Star Wars. So we sort of, the curriculum for the movie classes over the years has kind of come to address a lot of shortcomings and people coming in completely blank. So I now require people to watch movies in like 8 different genres minimum, so at least everyone can tell me what a Western is and everyone can tell me what an inspirational teacher movie is, just so we have this base knowledge. The difficulty is that I think that no one individual can kind of sort of be excellent at everything, so you hopefully have a group that kind of balances out where there's a really strong genre guy and a really strong character guy, but everyone else, you know, everyone should have at least abilities in all quarters. So the thing that I'm emphasizing now in the movie is kind of, I think, a relic of an earlier stage of the theater and maybe Chicago, where you need the 25 minutes. You're trying to do a 90-minute movie already condensed down. So in a lot of places where they only give you a 10-minute slot, it's almost impossible to do a movie. It sort of requires you have a dedicated group that rehearses together, which isn't necessarily going to happen. And all of them will make the movie their top priority, which is like even, you know, 6 years ago, people didn't want to do.
Sure.
So what I'm trying to emphasize is we learn the movie for the class performances, but also take away from it parts of the movie you can incorporate into your Herald. Like either doing the odd genre-based scene in your Herald, using that kind of sense of the visual in your Herald and sort of blocking, using the stage space, sort of playing characters that are big but committed to their reality. So all things that are essential to the movie but sort of enrich a Herald in a way that doesn't break the Herald. So that's sort of the background to my teaching in the last couple times I've taught it. But the movie's definitely fun. I think everyone should give it a shot and try it out. And definitely see it. And I'd love it to do the movie myself if it was ever possible again. But like I said, it's such a sort of energy suck of a group to be in. You have to really commit to it or do an adaptation of it, which Anthony Atamanik and Neil Casey do, the two-man movie, which is not exactly a movie, but sort of the greatest hits of the form in a two-person condensed version. And they occasionally do it, and it's a lot of fun. Even though it's missing like a lot of the elements that make the big movie so strange.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your sort of comedy identity. Like your illustrations with Mad Men right now are getting a lot of attention. And in this community, always your illustration and design work have gotten a lot of attention because you've designed a lot of flyers over the years.
Yeah, I've done a couple hundred.
You were the go-to person and still pretty much are the go-to person for posters and flyers, or maybe not so much now, but for a long time you were.
You can't afford me, so.
That's true.
But your look helped define like the theater in terms of the ads and the flyers and the posters, certainly in its early years and for a long time into it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely appreciate it, and I was able to pay my rent for many years on designing Del Close Marathon materials and so on. But it seems very bizarre that I'm now known in the wider world, primarily as an illustrator. I feel like an idiot who got famous for their day job instead of what they meant to be doing.
You're a lifelong comedy nerd.
I'm a lifelong comedy nerd, and comedy's always been my primary objective. And the problem is it's very hard to make money doing that, but it's slightly less hard to make money designing flyers. So that became my And it's, you know, to be fair, like in the early days of the theater, you wanted to make yourself useful to the UCB so that they would remember you. And the fact that I knew how to make flyers and use a computer, which was an odd skill back then, sort of, I'll admit it that I kind of flyered my way into their good graces, which, you know, after that, hopefully they notice your great talent, but it's like that old theater adage is never let them know you can do lights or you'll end up doing lights for the rest of your life kind of deal.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it definitely made me more essential than I should have been early on, being able to do flyers and do them for no money. So that sort of was my foothold.
Well, you're one of these people, and there's a lot of people like this in our in the UCB community who sort of, like, seems to know, like, comedy history a lot. Like, I feel like you have a really good knowledge. I feel like you're one of these, like, media absorbers where you know a lot of the stuff going on, like, in, I'm going to say it now in the stupidest way, which reveals my own lack of preparedness for this interview. But, like, you know, like, you'll know, like, all the shows going on in Britain. You'll have access to bizarre YouTube clips of, like, oh, here's, this didn't happen, but here's, like, when Rodney Dangerfield and Gabe Kaplan simulated fellatio on The Tonight Show, and that never got shown again, but I found this clip of it. Here it is, except there's like ZZ Top The Grange underneath for whatever reason.
Well, this putting The Grange under everything is actually a Matt Cutler joke, but I did do that to many clips. And by the way, I hope that you recreate that fictional clip.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I want to see that.
I think it's a Gen X-y thing, this kind of like, and it sort of it spills over in other things too of seeking out the most awful moments of our media past and capturing them and re-exposing them to the world. But yeah, I spend a lot of time on the computer is basically what I got out of that, and I send you a lot of emails.
You've been on a lot of other.
But yes.
What have you done as a performer? You've been in a million Harold teams. You're in my Harold team.
Yeah, Monkey Dick's the second best thing I'm known for, I think, even though I wasn't on Monkey Dick very long.
Well, you're over a year, year and a half?
Yeah, it was maybe a year. But, like, you were on it for 12 years.
I was on it for, like, 15 years.
Yeah.
You're still on Monkey
I'm
Dick.
I'm still on it, yeah. You were on it for a year and a half, though, and I think that team, you know, all sloppy dudes, then you'd come out, like, in some, you know, Japanese dress and, like, make a reference to what a certain phylum of snail.
You know, we instituted a Monkey Dick rehearsal where we had to do impressions of each other.
Yeah.
Do you remember this?
Yeah, yeah.
And you ended up as me.
Oh, yeah, and you didn't recognize.
And it was just you.
Well, I didn't want to do this. Yeah.
You listing facts about Satanism.
Is that right?
While breaking someone else's neck.
That's not so bad. I wanted to do a non-obvious Dynamo
impersonation. Curtis's impression was just me saying, well, in a really whiny way, which was, like, weirdly spot on.
Yeah.
Something that you just said about the weird dresses reminds me of one of the shows that you created, which is you did Neo Tokyo Girl Crush, right? That was your one of the shows that you created.
I created a show called Neo Tokyo Girl Crush 2040, mm-hmm. Which we did in 2002, and then there was a new version we did in 2004 with a completely different script. And, like, that was what I was referring to, like, the sort of earlier on in the theater, you could kind of put up these really strange, super epic, crazy shows that took tons of time and effort and money for no reward and be okay with it. I mean, that's not just the theater history, that's my own. It's anyone's history going, yeah, I'll spend $2,000 making a show no one's going to see.
Right.
And sort of that impulse fades with time. But Neo Tokyo Girl Crush, I'm very super proud of, and if you saw it, you know why, and if you didn't, then you'll just have to...
Well, for a theater where most of the shows are very minimalist and sparse, because it's like people improvising, so you have no set direction. This one had, like, full costumes, lots of sound effects.
We had three tech people.
People dressed in all black to affect things on stage.
Yeah,
we
used
for those people.
Kabuki stagehands called Kuroko.
Yeah.
Which are black-clad, invisible stagehands that move props around, which we used for flying and fighting effects. We also had a character who was just a puppet, which Will Hines understudied in one show.
But Terry Jin
was the main one. And the weird thing is that, you know, at the end of this show, I had, like, three crates of props, most of which I just left in the office.
The rape tentacle is in the lights of the
office. And two of the bakus are sitting on your shelves.
Yeah.
which were the Magix Hello Kitty style seal puppets that owned a huge major Japanese corporation. Neo Tokyo Girl Crush was super duper funny, and it's another show that suffered from the L.A. bleed. So you know,
you had heavy hitters in that show. Gethard was in that. McBrayer, Cordry, no, Seth Morris,
Seth, Jackie Clark, Husky was in the second one. Secunda was in the first one.
That's right. In video form.
In video form. He was trapped in another dimension.
Right.
So he was unable to come. That basically was, he didn't want to come to the show, so I videotaped him and made him stuck in another dimension.
Mm-hmm. For people who haven't seen the show, can you give it a quick summary?
It is live action Japanese anime on stage. The first plot had to do with a Japanese super-powered sailor suit-wearing superhero doing a student exchange in an American high school. And then while being pursued by a variety of evil, almost universally rapist monsters. And then there was a giant robot battle with like three nerds piloting a Voltron-style robot versus a giant seal monster. And then the second one had to do with an American coming to Neo Tokyo to teach English to superheroes and monsters. And then there's also a huge battle and a baby bee that has a tentacle neck that shoots bukkake in people's faces. It was sort of taking the lesson of the movie where you take a genre and you play every game you can think of that go with that genre, written down and done as a stage show. And tons of people were in it and tons of people were great in it. But it's sort of, I've thought about doing a new version of it, but I just don't know the people who'd be able to do it.
Yeah.
Because I knew Jackie and Seth for like a zillion years, and they were the main cast members other than me that were in both versions of the show.
Mm-hmm.
They were the bad guys and I was the good guy.
It was a fun show. I mean, it looked amazing.
Yeah.
Production quality was super high.
And it's one of those shows that people still talk about, you know.
I know that Mike Myers liked it. He came, Mike Myers of Austin Powers and so on.
Sure.
And the Love Guru.
I know who you're talking about.
And the Love Guru and So I Married an Ex-Murderer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, now I know.
Yeah. he just sort of came apropos of nothing and enjoyed it and called the office to tell them how much they liked it, but I didn't actually hear directly from him. But the biggest problem with that is I had various people come in and want to do something with it. Morgan Spurlock among them.
Really?
Yeah, before anyone knew who he was, he showed up and decided he wanted to produce it as a pilot, and then I was told by a different MTV executive that he was full of crap and I shouldn't listen to him. So I ended up not doing anything with him. And he made me a little nervous anyway, but an MTV executive saying, he's just a guy who pitches stuff here, we never buy his stuff, made me not want to work with him. And then there was, like, a company that wanted to make it a video game. I mean, like, there were really, I had tons of meetings, and all of them were, you know, came to nothing, and kind of, I was like, oh, well, this is a waste of time. So I've thought about sort of bringing some element of Girl Crush back, but it's sort of one of those huge 10-headed monsters that it seems so insurmountable to try and put it together from a standing stop.
From getting the cast together to having to reproduce all those props and costumes.
And rewrite it. I mean, the other thing is that doing an anime show seems very sort of weird and edgy in 2002 and seems kind of old hat in 2010, but that might just be me. Like, you know, it's what's sort of relevant and current and cutting edge.
You're asking the wrong guy. I still want to do a Gin Blossom show.
Well, that becomes more cutting edge as the time passes.
I'll do a Doug Hopkins-style anime show. What else do we have to cover here, John? We've hit most of the big points, right?
Yeah, we talked about the book and the movie and flyers and things like that.
I had a one-man show. You want to talk about that?
Oh, yeah.
I had a show. It was called Riot Nerd. It had a live rock band in it.
That's right. I forgot all about Riot Nerd.
And then the Ergs became super famous in a very small quarter of the world, and then they broke up. That's all they have to say about Riot Nerd.
How were the Ergs connected to Riot Nerd?
They were in it.
Yeah.
Oh.
They were live on stage. Mm-hmm. They played a set in between each section of the show.
Yeah.
And then that show stopped.
I'm almost positive I saw the show once, but I don't remember the specifics of it. So can you talk about what the show was?
You know, it's one of those things where I felt like I should do a one-man show and actually hated doing it. So
what did you hate about it?
I'm just not that kind of person. I don't like putting myself out there. I don't think I'm a big enough draw to be audience. I mean, I don't think that an audience deserves to have to sit through me for 40 minutes.
I think it's fair to say, you wouldn't say this, Dinah, but certainly at that time, you were like UCB celebrity, you know, that weird animal that exists only within the community. Like, you were, you know, sort of like had a very particular style of dress. You were on teams with people like a lot older than you and more senior. So you stood out as sort of like, who's that?
I have a fake name.
You have a ridiculous name. You do seem fictional as you walk through from a distance. Like, you're like, who? What's the cartoon doing on a feature? I mean, and so I think, like,
I had rainbow colored hair is what you
had. Rainbow colored hair, a mm-hmm. name that sounded and in fact was made up. and you were performing with the heavy hitters, yet you were younger than most of them, and it was more male to female heavy then. So yeah. You were one of the.
The weird thing is, at the very beginning, I think it was like 50-50. In terms of teen, and I'm talking about like the very, very beginning. Like, one of the reasons I wanted to start doing UCB is that if you looked at Mortal Kombat or in the Herald Net when I finally saw it, is they would have like, you know, three or more women on each team. Right. Granted, some of them were mentally unstable.
Sure.
And pretending to be bears. But there was like, I was like, wow, this is like amazing how many women they've got on here.
Yeah, so it's, and it's also true that like, you do need to have a certain need to have a certain attitude of like, I deserve to be having a solo show that people should be coming to watch in order to do one.
Yeah, which is sort of why I was always making fun of one-woman shows, and everyone was, is this certain kind of, you have to have a either faked or actual sort of arrogance and narcissism to go, I'm going to sing my favorite show tunes and then pull hats off this clothesline and, you know, whatever it was. And, like, you know, one-woman shows are hilarious as a concept, and one-man shows to a degree as well, although there's a certain sort of weird love-me actor quality that I don't possess and can't even fake. So doing the one-man show was super uncomfortable the whole time for me. I didn't want to be doing it. So that was part of the reason I put a rock band on stage, was to distract from my one-man show. It's like, at least you'll get a free rock show out of it too. But yeah, it was basically about, I went to and then was a counselor at a variety of nerd summer camps, like educational summer camps. Mm-hmm. So it was about nerd camps. I was a computer camp counselor. I taught people HTML and Flash 3.
That's amazing.
They were all under the age of 11.
Yep. And now,
oh God.
Now they're running the onion.
Now I'm dating them.
Well, so what's next for you, Dan? I think we have to kind of wrap this up.
Yeah, sure. So you have the movie class, the advanced class that you're teaching.
It's up tonight, if this goes up. It's up next week is the last one. If you like it, sign up for the movie class whenever it's offered next, most likely in 12 months. Or give or take, if there's more demand. please buy the Mad Men book. If it sells well enough, they'll let me do a book that isn't about Mad Men, which I'm looking forward to.
Oh, nice.
Theoretically. Like,
you're going to LA for a book signing, too.
The world at large will let me do a non-Mad Men book, theoretically, if this book sells. There's no deal in place.
Right.
I'm going to LA the weekend after Thanksgiving to do a signing and reading and, to be honest, a performance. I'm going to try and dig up as many people to bring the book alive at the signing as possible. So if you're in LA and you do a great Bob Dylan, give me a call. other than that, you know, making videos, I do a lot of videos, check them out, and hopefully have some more videos up before the year's out. And that's about it. If anyone wants me to do something, I guess contact me, and I'll probably be available. that's all I got.
Well, thank you, Dinah.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dinah. This has been great.
I hope it's useful.
Yeah, totally.
All right, come back next week for another episode of this nonsense.
Yeah, we're back on track, it seems like.
I feel like nothing ever went wrong.
Maybe people will forgive us.
Yes.
All right, thanks, and we'll see you next week. Goodbye, Will.
Goodbye, John. Bye, Dinah.
Bye, Dinah. Bye.